We're ready for 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 26 and 27. We've reached the point where we are about to the end of the chapter. That's going to bring us to the end once we get through verse 27. Paul, if you will recall from our last study, he was talking about the Christian life in terms of a race or athletics. The ancient world, they had something that was would be like the Olympic Games. People trained long and hard for them. They were in the area of Corinth. We said that it's very possible that Paul actually saw those games. And that brings us then to 1 Corinthians 9, 26 and 27. He says, I therefore, talking about himself personally, I therefore so run. And he said, I run as not uncertainly. So fight I as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and bring it into bondage, lest by any means, after that I have preached to others, I myself should be rejected. This is Paul's conclusion to the discussion as far as running the Christian race. He said, if you have the King James translation, he says, I ran without uncertainty. That's older language for us. The ASV says, maybe a little more clearly, not uncertainly. That is, he's saying that as he looked at the spiritual part of life, as he thought about the Christian race, he knew what was going on. He was aware of the goal. Do you find people in life who really don't have any goals? Anybody ever count somebody like that? What's life lived? What kind of life do you live if you don't have any goals? What do people do?
Just mundane.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, they drift from day to day. They just kind of get through the day, and then tomorrow comes. What am I going to do today? Well, I don't know. You know, we'll just kind of see where the day goes. And they don't have any kind of goal at all. When you get to the end of life, if you don't have any goals, where are you going to be? I saw a study. This is really scary. As far as younger generation, it talked about financial literacy. If I remember the percentage correctly, it was just a quick news blurb this morning that I saw. 40% of people in the U.S. right now, at least of the ones surveyed, don't have an understanding of what an IRA is. I was stunned by that. 40% of young people have no idea what an IRA is. They also talked about some other things when it came to financial literacy. If you don't have a goal for retirement, guess what? You're going to be working for a long time in old age. You're going to be in serious, serious trouble. And this is also true in the spiritual realm. People don't oftentimes have any goals. They just sort of blindly go here and go there, and they're wandering aimlessly about. Paul said, that's not how I'm living my Christian life. I, number one, know what I want. And number two, I know how to get it. And number three, I'm going to be persistent in pursuing it. Those three things are a great strategy for any goal, any worthwhile goal in life. Number one, you have to know what you want. But oftentimes, don't we find illustrations of in life where people don't know what they want? Where do we see that? People don't know what they want.
Purchasing clothes.
Well, it might be purchasing something. I mean, people, you know, you find people who will purchase a car, they don't like it, then they purchase another one, another one. It just looks like they can't ever quite get a good fit. Sometimes it might be clothing. Where else do you see it, though? Yeah.
They don't know what they want to do when they...
Or even college kids. They start this major and then maybe jump over to that major and then leave school for a while. And maybe that's understandable to some degree. Brian, what did you have to say?
College was my idea.
Okay. What about in the secular work world? Anybody ever encounter somebody who went from job to job to job to job? They just never could really find something that sat well with them. I mean, they're hopping all over and, you know, what's your job history? And they've got 10 pages practically. So it's very difficult, and sometimes people do that in the spiritual realm. They will hop around from religious group to religious group because they don't know what they want. They should want the truth. Paul knew, as we said, how to get it, and he was going to persistently pursue it. So he is like that athlete. Anybody ever do anything as far as athletics, especially running? Anybody ever a runner? Okay. What was it like to run? What did you run? Do you remember?
I had to run a lot for the police academy, but I was a swimmer.
Okay. All right. So swimming works too. When you were a swimmer, we'll just use that one. What was on your mind when you're in the pool? And it's a swimming competition. You had a goal to meet, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you were either trying to get down and back, or you're trying to get down and you're trying to be in probably first or at least place. You had a specific plan in mind. Now, maybe you didn't succeed, but at least that was a goal. I didn't want to cut you off, but
I was going to say, move as hard and as fast as I could go to keep myself streamlined. The one that was really tricky when you're swimming is the backstroke, because you have to know how far from the wall you are to turn. Mm-hmm. So usually there's like a streamer across it when you get kind of close, and you have to know how many strokes you have until you can flip, and that can be, you know, it can be a little really, you can't reach it if you turn too late, you're hitting your head on it.
Runners may do the same thing. They know, for example, that maybe they have 15 seconds of a sprint as far as their ability, and it's when do I use that? So you're planning and you're trying to process things so that you're going to compete successfully. Looking at the end of verse 6, and then we'll see if we have some more hands. What's the illustration at the end of verse 26? Paul says, I
run.
No, not at the end of verse 26.
Be in the air.
All right. Do you have the word fight? About the middle of the end of verse 26? Okay, we've got the word fight or something similar. And then, Don, you gave the rest of the answer. What was it? I don't.
I do not box if one beat in the air.
All right, box instead of fight, but I do not beat the air. Anybody ever see, maybe this was a boxing match, or maybe this was something on TV you saw, program, or maybe you were actually in a fist fight. You know, here's the guy, you know, he comes back for the old right cross, and he's going to really smack the guy, and the guy moves out of the way at the last second. What happens? I mean, you see all the energy, boy. I mean, he's really going to lay him on the ground. Whack! And what happens?
He misses him.
You know, here's the guy. He's pounding the air. And, you know, he might actually fall over. That's not the best move in the world if you're trying to lay out the opponent. And Paul says, I'm not like that guy. If you use the boxing realm, Paul says, when I throw a punch spiritually, when I am pursuing my goal, I mean, it's like throwing a dart at the dartboard. What do you want to do if you're playing darts? Well, you hopefully at least want to be on the board. Ideally, you're going to hit the center. You don't want to hit 6 feet from the target, do you? You want to be on the board. And that's what Paul is saying. I want to make sure that spiritually my punches land. So one source said, he who runs with a clear aim, looks straight and runs straight to the goal, casts away every weight and pays no regard to what bystanders say, and sometimes is but aroused even by a fall. Paul did not want to miss the mark, just like a knowledgeable fighter. When you look at the verbs which are translated fight or box and beat, they are present tense, and it is a very, very vivid illustration. Now for us, as we think about modern boxing, you've got the guys out there with the gloves. Things were a little more rough and tumble in the ancient world. They talk about fighters who had thongs tied to their hands and wrists. There are also no time rounds. When we think about boxing today, sometimes other athletics, they ding the bell and that's it for the round. But in this particular time, things were a little different. Anything that you want to add or ask over verse 26, 1 Corinthians 9? Okay, let's move down to verse 27. That's going to continue the information that we have there in verse 26. Paul's still talking about a physical contest. And what's he say here? He says, I do what to my body? All right. You think that means he went out to Golden Corral? He's not talking about buffet in the sense of buffet. What's he mean? He says, I buffet my body. Not that I go out and eat all I can eat, but... All right, I discipline my body. I am very, very careful when it comes to the spiritual part of life. I keep it under control. We're going to see this from another passage, but you remember in Galatians chapter 5, Paul said the flesh, that part of us which says that sin is attractive sometimes, he says the flesh does what when it comes to the spirit? The flesh fights, or the flesh lusts against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and he says these two things are contrary one to another. Paul is... this person who says, I want to do what's right. But sometimes, even though I want to do what's right, I also have a desire to do what? Wrong. So here's the person. You think about it from this perspective, a food perspective. Here's the individual who says, I'm on a diet. And I'm not going to eat cake. I'm not going to eat cookies. I am knocking off the ice cream. But what happens?
He indulges.
All right. You know, here comes the evening. You know, maybe watching a little TV. Hungry before bed. Let's go get some cookies. Let's raid the ice box and let's get some ice cream. Why? I mean, you're on the diet. Why do that? Because this side of your head says, you're on a diet, avoid the stuff. This side of the head says what? I'm hungry, that would really be yummy, and I have it, let's go get it. Well, sin operates in that same way. Paul says, I buffet my body. That word is only used here and in Luke chapter 18 and verse 5. And in Luke 18 and verse 5, it's an interesting place. That's the place where you have this widow who is trying to get justice from a judge, and she goes and she talks to the judge. Does the judge want to help her? Nope. So she goes back, and she goes back, and she goes back. If you look at that word in the original text, it had the sense of striking someone under the eyes in such a way where he got a black eye. If you're going to hit somebody in that way, you're going to probably pound him pretty good. And in Luke chapter 18, it seems like the word describes the judge's prestige. I don't think she actually blackened his eye. I mean, I guess that's possible. A woman could do that to a guy. But here she is going to persist and does persist so that she finally gets her way. And that's what Paul says to my body. Do a lot of people see sin as being so serious that they're willing to buffet their body? Or do you think they have a much milder view, a more lax view of sin?
Might be a few that be pretty serious about it.
But there might be a few. But do you think that there's some people who say, well, hey, everybody sins. You know, it's no big deal. My sin isn't nearly as great as so-and-so's. And, you know, I'm sure God is just pleased with that. But Paul, as he looks at sin, he knows how serious it is. He says, that's something that I really try to avoid in my life. That is a mark of a mature Christian. Trying to look at sin and say, okay, none of us are perfect. Bible certainly teaches that in a lot of different places, but we're going to live the best possible life. When you look at that word which is translated buffet, what would you suspect about the tense? Past, present, or future? I buffet my body. It's going to be present, and that is the correct answer. And it's got to be understood figuratively. That doesn't literally mean that Paul hit himself. He was not going to engage in self-abuse. It simply means that he tried to keep the passions in his life under control so that he could live the heavenly race. One other quick point here, and then we'll stop and talk about the word bondage. When you look at people, and maybe not so much on the professional level, but when you look at people who are athletes, maybe at the high school level, when they're talking about the football game, when they're talking about the upcoming track meet, whatever it might be, what do you often hear as far as boasting? Do you hear any boasts? Hear any bragging?
Yes.
Yeah. Common boasts might be what?
We're on a winning streak.
Well, that could be one thing. What about from an individual? Are there people who boast and brag how they're going to go and win? They're going to cream everybody. They're going to come in first and all those kinds of things. We do hear that from people, but that's not Paul's attitude. As he looks at his life, and we're going to see this especially a little bit more as we get down a little more deeply into verse 27, he says, there's a chance that I could be what? 1 Corinthians 9:27. I could be disqualified. I could be lost. I could be rejected. Anything that you want to discuss before you say a little bit more? Don?
Discipline my body under control. I'm thinking about the Christian. Discipline our spiritual control. We can't do it by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to have help. If I didn't come to Bible study, if I didn't come to church, if I didn't mingle with other Christians, and I said, well, I can just do it myself, it ain't going to work. I can't control myself that way. I need somebody to punch me in the nose a little bit to it, and say, hey, this is what you should do, God. I said, you know, you're right.
Practice it. Right. God has some tools in place to help us do what Paul was doing. Fellowship with other Christians would be one of those tools. If we take that tool out of the toolbox, then that struggle does become even more difficult. You're correct.
Some Christians, maybe myself, guilty too, we're concerned about talking to other Christians that need to be talked to because we don't want to lose our friendship. We don't want to hurt their feelings. But sometimes, as Christians, we need our feelings hurt a little bit. As long as we can go to the Bible and say, this is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Maybe they know the Bible, but they just forgot that particular scripture. So I'm a little bit leery of telling us, because I'm not. I mean, if I was you, Brad, I wouldn't have any trouble talking to someone. But me, I had to be stepping close. I had to know what I'm talking about before I even talk about it.
Well, you never know, Don. Some skills are acquired. Some may be a little more natural to some others. If you see the video that I put out on YouTube today, Stop for Gas, probably about 1 o'clock this afternoon, and pulled in, got about halfway through the fueling process, and another car pulls in. Didn't want fuel. They wanted to talk to me. I guess they saw how I was dressed, so a lady hops out of the car, and she comes up, and she says, I'd like to give you something. And she hands me a little pamphlet on suffering. I, you know, looked at it and immediately thought, you're from the Jehovah Witnesses. And she said, that's true. And I said, well, and then I engaged her in a spiritual discussion, got her phone number, and I'm going to text her some information tonight. So you never know sometimes, as far as some people are just really comfortable with that. I mean, that took some guts to just pull off. I have no idea where she was headed, but they didn't get gas. She pulled in there just to talk to me. And I have never had that happen to my recollection in life, that somebody made a special stop just to jump out and say, hey, we'd like you to take one of our tracks. So that is a skill that can be developed.
You're special, Brad.
Yeah, I guess.
brother.
Yeah.
What was it?
Suffering. Maybe she thought that I looked like I was having a hard day. I don't know. All right. Let's see what else we've got. Bondage. We've also got that word in the text, okay? If you have the King James translation, that's going to be rendered subjection. That word is found only here in the New Testament. It's also a present tense verb. In classical Greek, it described people who had been captured and made slaves. And that term, that background, that present tense says that Paul's becoming a Christian. It did not remove temptation from his life. We can look at Paul and think, kind of, you know, he was a super Christian who never struggled with temptation. He was just natural in the kinds of ways that Don talked about. He never had any fear as far as talking to somebody, going anyplace. I mean, he was just sort of this almost robot for God. And he makes it clear that's not true. He says, I was flesh and blood. I had the same kinds of struggles that you did. You know, there. Acts chapter 18 talks about the fear that he had when he came to the Corinthian area. And back in Romans chapter 7, verses 14 and 15, he talked about how there were times where he wanted to do good, what those urges to go to the freezer, get the ice cream, so to speak, but only in the spiritual realm, those were a little more appealing to him. And there were some times where he wanted to do what was right, but he did what was wrong. So when we think about Paul, the struggle that he went through, the Christian race that he had to run, it was real for him. And that's what he's telling the Corinthians. That's what he's telling us. This is going to be a real race for you. You, if you're really trying to live the Christian life, you're going to struggle. You're going to have some times where you are successful. You're going to have some times where you fail. And you just mark that down as far as this being part of your Christian life. That's an important lesson, I think, for everybody. Why would that be important for older people? Older people. Folks who have kind of reached the season where they're thinking, all right, we don't have a lot of time left. Why would that message be important? Well, that would be true. I don't know that I'm going to put that as my top answer, but that would be an answer. Anybody want to offer something additional? Well, think about it this way. You know, here's a person who's tried to live for God, and they look at their life and they say, okay, I've been a Christian for 60 years. But even though, let's just use greed for an example, okay? Here's a person who says, all of my life I've struggled with greed. Now, from one perspective, if a person has been a Christian for 60 years, they're now 80 years old, wouldn't you hope that they would have overcome greed by the age of 80?
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people are getting rid of all their stuff by 80. You know, they don't want more. But here this person says, I am still greedy. And they feel bad. They feel awful. They feel like they are some kind of second-class citizen. What's 1 Corinthians 9 say? You might be old, but what? Are you still going to struggle with sin sometimes?
Yes.
So if you're struggling with greed or something else at 80, okay. You know, Paul had those same struggles. What about the person who's in the middle years? They say, you know, we've, you know, no longer a teenager. Sure, you know, we are not in the senior years right now. But, you know, we're struggling with this, that, and the other thing. And we're trying to live the Christian life, trying to do what is good and right and acceptable to God. But, man, we've really got it tough in some areas. Maybe with the kids, maybe husband-wife relationship, whatever it is. Should what we find in 1 Corinthians 9 encourage them? Yeah, you're going to have some struggles too. And what about for young people? You know, they can hear, Trace?
Well, I was just thinking, we learn to control one thing and then another one pops up, and that's continual.
Yeah, it's like fixing a leak.
It's a continual growing process, no matter how old we are. A new sin is going to pop into our life,
yeah.
And we're going to have to overcome it.
You plug the hole over here? Over here, another one pops up at some point. And it's like whack-a-mole. You get rid of this one, and there's another one that pops up over here. For young people, you know, going through a time where a lot of changes are taking place, hormones are raging, decisions can be very difficult, and they look and think, wow, you know, living the Christian life is really tough. It is really hard. This is a very, very practical section of 1 Corinthians to share with people, especially younger folks. Anything that you want to add or ask? Tim, and then we'll maybe Adam.
When we're thinking about how things are not going right with our life, we need to stop and think about somebody else's life who is experiencing a lot worse problems than we are. Maybe even to the point where we can lose ourselves and their problems by helping them.
Yeah, a great point, and that's absolutely right. Adam, did you have a point, or did I mistake the hand?
With just life in general, knowing that even as an apostle that had so much knowledge, for someone that's in a position of leadership and example, and we see them as doing all these great things, whether it's an apostle or, you know, when we're growing up, like our parents or grandparents or the elders in our congregation and stuff like that, and we see someone like that talk about that they have their own struggles and that they just work as hard as they can because no one's perfect, it really helps to calm your perfectionist idea that you may have of a Christian or what you feel like you should be, and can understand, and it can help you to understand what like John and James talk about, with just walking in the light, doing the best that you can, and you know, we're all on the same struggle.
Yeah. That's true. And for a lot of people who become Christians, it takes a long time for them to realize it. There have been a number of cases where someone came to that understanding. There was a person that they really looked up to, and one day, through maybe a happenstance conversation, whatever it might be, they came to realize that that person struggles with something, maybe multiple things, just like they do, and that was a major revelation for them. They thought, I would have never suspected that of you, that you, you know, maybe, you know, who knows what it is. It could be an action, it could be a thought, it could be any number of things, and they're just stunned by it. But I mean, Paul gives us that insight into his life and tells us that that's going to be true for every single Christian as well. That it? Don, back to you.
You were talking about old folks.
I did?
I'm an old folk.
Okay.
You know that.
What?
One of the great things about being an old folks is, and you're a good Christian, you don't have to worry about things. But worry can kill you. So if you don't worry about where you're going to end up, that is a great big load off your back. Young people, a lot of times, don't have that sincere belief in God that we old people do. We know we don't have long to go. And the closer we get to the time, that's the end of it. We don't, I don't mean to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Facetious in this. But it's not that I want to die. If I die tomorrow, or I die 2 weeks from now, or I die of cancer, or whatever, that's okay. But I don't know where I'm going.
You made a good comment, and you opened up another good thought. And that is, as you think about the struggle, what somebody's going to struggle with at the age of 17, do you think that's probably going to be the same struggle that they have at 75?
No.
No.
Now, that's important. Because a lot of times, I think, as people look at struggles, they would say, well, you know, this is really something that bothers me right now. And it might. And maybe it's a struggle for just you. Maybe it's a struggle for most people in that age group. But struggles typically change with life. What's going to be a battle in the teenage years is probably not going to be a battle for a senior citizen. And there can be exceptions to that, but generally speaking, that's true. And it's important for people to realize that the battle is going to shift with time. So what may seem insurmountable right now is one day probably going to morph into something else. And that might be better, it might be easier, it might be worse, we don't know, or it might be about the same. But it is going to change. If people are not aware of that, then they need to be told. Adam, and then we'll see if that's...
You know, like you said, there are things that you struggle with, younger, that you may not as you get older because you worked on those things. But things like that as well, some of those like core struggles that you may have had, even if it's not really difficult for you to resist as you go on in life, if you also don't pay, if you start to not really pay attention to that, those same struggles can come back with, as they would say, with a vengeance. And that can be more difficult later in life of something that you've just decided that's not really an issue for me anymore.
You are correct. And I believe that's why Paul uses these two key words, buffet and bondage. We're trying to go ahead and address these issues as aggressively as we possibly can. Someone said, and I like the quote, it's easy to love Jesus, but loving Jesus is not easy. Christianity requires, if you're really going to live a life, a lot of ongoing effort. Paul brought his desires and life into subjection to God for what reason? This is going back to verse 27, the end of the verse. He says, lest by any means what? I should be disqualified, or I should be rejected. If anybody have the King James translation, that I should be a castaway. Very good. That adverb, lest, occurs after verbs of fear, apprehension, to voice a speaker's negative reservation. So this is something that concerned Paul. What do you think he means when he says, lest I be a someone who's disqualified, a castaway, or someone who is rejected? What's he saying?
He didn't want to be responsible for someone else sinning.
Well, no. He says, lest I be rejected, lest I be a castaway. Let's take another shot at that.
He's telling others, but if he misses it himself.
Yes. Yes, and that disqualification is another way of saying?
Well, lost, for one.
All right, that's what it boils down to. Hell, separation from God, not going to heaven. Tim, I didn't want to cut you off there.
Same.
Okay, so you had the answer. Very good. I kind of thought you did. We talked about this extensively in the Sunday morning class as far as Galatians chapter 5 and verse 4. Paul said that if the Galatians followed the Judaizers, they would be severed from Christ. I gave you a couple of quotes from denominational writers as far as how they try to explain that away. People have the same problem here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 when they try to say, well, Paul didn't mean that he could lose his salvation. It's really some twisted logic and reasoning. Here is, from a different source, an explanation for 1 Corinthians 9 as far as a denial that Paul's not saying what he said. Like the brother who had indulged in immorality back in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, the source says Paul's life could be cut short by the disciplinary disapproval of God. God had disciplined in the past. We're going to see that in 1 Corinthians 10, 6 through 10. He was disciplining in the present that we're going to see from 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And he would discipline in the immediate future going back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul was concerned that some might not be able to say with him one day, I fought the good fight, I finished the race, but would find themselves cut off in the midst of the contest by the disciplinary action of God. Now, if you want to boil that down, it simply means that people will look at this, if they don't believe that salvation can be lost, and say, well, God was just going to cut his life short. If he would have normally lived to 80, then he would have died at 50 or something like that. Well, Paul didn't have that in mind. He says, I would be a castaway. And that word described a person or a thing which failed to pass a test and therefore was rejected. It was disqualified. It was deemed to be unacceptable. Castaway, give you the quote here, was used with reference to ancient coins, which were always weighed and otherwise carefully tested. The genuine and the full weight coins were accepted as proven, and the others were rejected as disproven. If we've ever done some factory work, you've got parts coming down the line, and if the part's good, what do you do with it? All right, you use it. You put it on the vehicle, or you put it wherever it needs to go, and if the part's bad, what do you do? I mean, it goes over in the scrap bin. You say that this one is not fit. It's not going to go in the vehicle. This is something that is not going to be serviceable. The term was also used for people who were disqualified as far as contestants in the Greek games. One source said there was a herald who announced the rules of the contest, the names of the contestants, and the names of the cities of the winners. He would also announce the names of any contestants that were disqualified. Paul, as he uses this word, he says he might not stand up to the test. He did recognize that he could be lost. One of the worst things, I think, I mean, it's bad if anybody goes to hell, but if the guy in the pulpit goes to hell, that's really sad. I mean, I'm not saying he's first in line, but if anybody, you know, should know how to get there and should be striving to live in a way which is going to please God and get you to heaven, it should be the guy who is preaching and teaching the gospel. But, you know, Paul recognized that that does not necessarily, just because you're the preacher, mean that you're going to be in a right relationship with God and be saved. Again, I'll stop here and see if there's something that you want to add or ask. Brian, to you.
This verse seems to really elevate the importance of bringing our body into subjection.
Yeah.
It's a salvation thing. 1 Timothy 4:8 seems to downplay how we treat our bodies, whereas mightily exercise profits, but just a little. Compared to godliness. How do you clear up that?
Okay, I think I would start with the end of the verse. As far as godliness is profitable for all things, godliness being parallel to buffeting the body. The exercise there would be, as we think of it, I'm going to go out and walk, I'm going to do the cardio and the other things. There would be some benefit in keeping the body physically fit, but the emphasis that the Christian wants to have is going to be spiritual fitness.
Okay. We don't. So the body and 1 Corinthians 9:27 is a spiritual application,
yes,
more than physical body.
Yeah, just as we wouldn't use our physical body to go out and hit somebody, or we would use our tongue to attack people. Yes. Very good question. Dolores?
Just when you were talking about a 17-year-old may not have the same struggle, it'll still be a struggle as the 70-year-old. I like the Holman standard. The Bible says, I discipline my body and I bring it under strict control.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a 17-year-old and a 72-year-old may have a different struggle, but
yes,
they have the same solution.
Absolutely.
To bring it under strict control.
Yes.
As long as you're under control, then I think that is the way we buffer ourselves.
It is. Very, very good. Thank you for sharing. Anybody else? Okay, let's talk about the introductory matters for 1 Corinthians chapter 10. As you look at the opening verse, 1 Corinthians 10, the American Standard uses the word for, King James has the word moreover. When somebody says moreover, additionally, furthermore, something like that, what are they telling you?
Got something else to say.
Okay, and this is probably going to have some connection to what we're talking about. We said some, and now we have a little bit more to say. If you back up a little bit, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul was talking about eating what kind of meat. There was a big discussion about idol meat. And he said that that practice was not wrong, but you do, he says, need to avoid it if that would do what? All right, if that's going to offend a fellow Christian, then you need to avoid that. The Corinthians, though, apparently believed that they could do whatever they wanted, even if that wounded the conscience of fellow Christians, and Paul had to get after them. We're going to see that again in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 23. It looks like the Corinthians reasoned that all things were lawful. We're a Christian. We've kind of seen that a little bit with some illegals in our country. If they're picked up, it's, I don't care what the laws are. I'm going to do what I want to do. You know, I'm here, and I've got freedom to do whatever I want. And that's kind of the Corinthians attitude that you have. So Paul used that attitude to, in the ninth chapter, to say, hey, look, we've got to work out our own salvation. And again, he uses himself at the end of the chapter to say, I buffet my body. I'm under strict control. You need to do that as well. You do not want to hurt a fellow athlete that is a fellow Christian and be disqualified from the spiritual race, from losing the heavenly reward. That kind of sets the stage for 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It looks like the Corinthians had concluded. We're going to see that they've been baptized into Christ. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 13. They got the impression that they had so much spiritual freedom in Christ that they could do whatever they wanted, eat the idol meat, do other stuff, engage in fornication, and do some of the other sins that you have been back in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It felt like to them that they could abuse the Lord's Supper, that we're going to read about in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. They could have a divided church that we have in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and that they did not need to run the Christian race. It's almost like sometimes some kids. You ever have to deal with a young person, perhaps, who comes into your house and says, hey, we're not at our house. We can do whatever we want here. Anybody ever have that experience? How do you feel when somebody comes to your house and behaves in that way? You probably think that's an issue, unless you live by that kind of idea. So Paul is going to say, hey, look, that's just not going to work. And he goes back to the Old Testament. He goes back to the nation of Israel for an example or for an illustration. Paul is going to talk about Israel, and he's going to make this point. God saved Israel, but then a little later, what did God do? God says, I brought you out. I delivered you. I was good to you. You weren't good to me. And what happens to you? All right, you get punished. The hammer was dropped on them. Paul's going to use the word all five times in the first four verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He's going to talk about Israel's deliverance from Egypt. And then he's going to go back to Psalm 105, verse 37. And he brought them forth with silver and gold. And there was not one feeble person among his tribe. So God did an amazing thing. God, though, wanted to bless his people, but that special status that he gave Israel was conditional. We'll see that in chapter 10, verses 6 through 10, and that's also true for the Christian life. God has all spiritual blessings for us, but we can be severed from Christ if we're not willing to follow the conditions. We must abide in his word. We've seen this problem in Galatians. It's also in the life of Christ. Many of the Jews felt like God was going to be okay with them, whatever they did, because they had ties to who? We are children of Abraham, right? Remember that? Because we've got the family connection, God is going to always care for us. Well, some of the Corinthians felt good. If you look ahead a little bit in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 16, Paul is going to say to the Corinthians, you have what? You've got the communion. You've got your supper. You've got this memorial. The Corinthians felt good about that. We're going to see in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 2, as well as 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 13, the Corinthians felt secure because they had their baptism. They were able to point to things like this and say, aha, just like Israel, God's delivered us, God has been good to us, and therefore we don't have anything to worry about. Is that a problem when you look at the Bible? It is. Do people sometimes have that idea today? You know, we're good because we have this and that. There are people who think that baptism is fire insurance. Anybody ever come across somebody who has that idea? I've been baptized, so God's not going to do what to me. I mean, I'm saved. I'm good. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. I don't have to be obedient. This is the kind of problem that Paul was dealing with when it came to the Corinthian church. So we only possess eternal security for walking in the light. One other quick thing, and then we'll pick up with 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. When you look at 1 Corinthians 10 verses 1 through 14, I think you get a picture of what a lot of the first century teaching was like. Maybe if they had Bible classes, or certainly at least some of the sermons, you kind of see three distinct things here. And that is, information from the scriptures was selected. Now that could have been, you know, done in a lot of different ways, just like today. People sometimes will think in terms of a series. There are some people who just sort of throw a dart at the Bible and say, this is going to be the text for this week. It's completely random. Other people have some other kind of study plan. But it looks like a text was selected. Second point, then that text was studied. It was examined, like we do in Bible class. And the number three, they made some attempts to apply that information to daily life. Not every sermon, not every class is probably going to be constructed in that kind of way, but that is a very effective way to do something. Hopefully you have some at least sort of organized way to study the Bible. You're going through a textual study, or maybe you're looking at a book which has a particular topic and that's divided up by chapters. And as you look at that information, then you try to study it. Class discussion can be an excellent way to study something out, get some input from various people, and then try to offer some application as well. If you can cover at least some of those three points in a teaching session, that's really what you see in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and that is a really good way to teach, at least in the spiritual realm. Anything that you want to add or ask before we read 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1? Okay. He says, "For I would not, brethren, have you ignorant, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea." First of all, Paul says to the Corinthians, I don't want you to experience something. I don't want you to be, what's the answer? I don't want you to be?
Mine says unaware.
All right, unaware. Some other versions might say ignorant. That is a present tense verb. And as you look ahead a little bit, he's talking about Israel's mistakes. I don't want you to be uninformed as far as our standing before God. When Paul uses the word ignorant in places like Corinthians and Romans, he's typically giving corrective instructions to congregations. Here it means, I want you to know. Israel was a great example for the things that Paul wanted to illustrate. A lot of the Corinthians, we're going to see this from places like 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 2, they were from a Gentile background. Now, if you were from a Gentile background, and you've got a guy like Paul coming in to talk to you, might you, if he's talking about how things were for the Jews, think, that really doesn't relate to us? I mean, if let's look at it in a different way. If you are dealing, we can look at it from a couple of perspectives. If you're dealing with a congregation in the Midwest, and somebody comes in and talks and starts talking about life on one of the coasts, you know, what's life, what it's like out there in California, and they get into what's happening on the beach and all the other stuff, are you going to feel like that really relates to your life?
Cultures.
We've got different cultures. So it was even more radical for the Jews and for the Gentiles. So as Paul's talking about Israel to people who were from a largely Gentile background, they might have been scratching their heads and thinking, hey, you know, that's not really our culture. We're from a completely different background. But Paul, as you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1, he uses a strange word. Look at it again. For I would not have you ignorant, brethren, or you Gentiles, that who are fathers. Isn't that kind of a strange thing to say to Gentiles? I mean, he's talking about what happened to the Jews. Why would he say our fathers when he's addressing people who were from a Gentile background?
He was giving them the history of how things worked out so that Christ came so that they could be Christians.
Yes, that is true. The Jews brought in Christ to the world, and there is a sense in which they are the spiritual father of all people. So all the saved lived under different covenants as you look at the Old Testament, but now as we think about salvation, they are joined together. So different ethnic backgrounds, but they were part of the spiritual family, of same as the Jews, and therefore brethren. You're going to see as you look at the first 13 verses, some parallels. I do at least want to get through these. I'll give you the Old Testament parallel, and then I'll let you figure out what the New Testament parallel is. The Hebrews were in Egyptian bondage, and who was the guy? Well, let's back up a little bit. They were in bondage. Was that physical bondage or was that spiritual bondage? All right, it was physical bondage. And who was the one who was holding them captive? Pharaoh. Okay, so Old Testament, Israel, physical bondage, Pharaoh. What would the New Testament parallel to that be? If it was physical bondage, then the New Testament parallel, the counterpart would be, all right, it would be spiritual. And it was in bondage as far as physical bondage. So we have bondage to, what's the spiritual bondage? It's going to be, well, no, the spiritual bondage is going to be sin, right? And Dolores got the next one ahead of me in just a second. Pharaoh was the guy who was in charge. New Testament, who's the guy who's in charge? It's going to be the devil. All right, number two. Was there a deliverer for the Exodus from Egypt? Yes, who was it? Moses. All right, and when we think it was God, but Moses was the one he used. Is there a spiritual deliverer when it comes to the church? Yes, who is that? Jesus. All right, very good. Was there a struggle with Pharaoh? Yes. Spiritually, is there a struggle? Yes, and it's going to be with the devil. All experience the sea. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is going to talk about that. We can go back to the book of Exodus and read about that as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says it's not a literal sea, but we've got information about baptism. We've got the people back in the book of Exodus. Everybody allowed to leave? Yep. What would the New Testament parallel to that be? Everybody can come out of Egypt. Everybody can and come into the church. Very good. We have physical freedom as far as the Exodus. New Testament, we have okay, or spiritual freedom. The Jews, they went out into the wilderness, and now we are where? We are in the church, which is in the world. All right, the Hebrew people, they got to Canaan. Where do we get to go? Canaan for the Jews, God's people. Where do we get to go? All right, we get to go to heaven. Some died before Canaan. What would be the parallel there? This is the last one. Some died before Canaan. That's true, but that's only part of it. Yes, there are going to be some people who don't make it. And that's what Paul warned about at the end of 1 Corinthians 9.